You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Detect, From Awareness to Action, Driving Multidisciplinary Application of Screening and Disease-Modifying Therapies in Early Stage T1D. Today, we are having a conversation with Ms. Lucia Novak, a board-certified nurse practitioner in adult health and advanced diabetes management. Lucia has been a nurse for more than 3 decades and has over 25 years of experience in diabetes and obesity. She is the president and founder of Diabesity LLC, based in North Bethesda, Maryland, and the co-executive director of Capital Health and Metabolic Center, which is a part of Capital Diabetes and Endocrine Associates, also in Maryland. Lucia's expertise in diabetes is a result of her vast involvement in clinical practice, research, education, authorship, professional speaking, and leadership in the field. Of note, she is a current member of the American Diabetes Association's Science and Healthcare Council Executive Committee and is the appointed chair of the Education Committee for the Endocrine Nurses Society. She has served as the past chair of the Credentialing Oversight Committee of the American Association of Diabetes Care and Education Specialists and as a member of the American Diabetes Association's Membership Advisory Group. Another notable achievement is her active duty service as a commissioned officer of the United States Army Nurse Corps, providing health care to the men and women of the U.S. military. Lucia, first of all, thank you for your service and thank you for joining our podcast.
Hi, Mel, and to all of our listeners, thank you so much for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun today.
Indeed, it will. Let's get right into a discussion about diabetes care and education specialists. What role do these clinicians have in early stage type 1 diabetes before a patient has symptoms or even needs insulin?
Well, that is a great way to start the conversation because the diabetes care and education specialists have a superpower, and it's really in how they engage the patient. In fact, the ADCES, which is the abbreviation for that very long title, recently published a position statement, and it's entitled The Role of the Diabetes Care and Education Specialist in Screening and Monitoring for Type 1 Diabetes. And it's in Volume 51, which is the more recent volume of The Science of Diabetes Self-Management and Care. When I read the article, to just summarize the key points of this position statements and how indeed the diabetes care and education specialist plays a critical role in improving access to care, enhancing health outcomes, as well as, and probably even more importantly, supporting the quality of life for individuals with early stage type 1 diabetes. And it lists as follows: having the ability to recognize who is at risk and recommend screening, educate patients as well as family members about the benefits and the process involved with screening. They have a unique ability to actually engage with the community and spread the word about the importance of identifying as well as actually performing screening in people who are at risk for type 1 diabetes. And actually explain, in addition to once those patients are screened or those individuals are identified, why ongoing monitoring is needing for those that are identified as being high risk. They provide the much needed emotional support for those that are undergoing screening. As we all know, anytime we do screening and we're waiting for results, there's a lot of anxiety. And when you're screening and monitoring for type 1 diabetes, it's not a one does it and you're done for life. It's something that's ongoing. And so having that emotional support is really needed. And of course, offering and providing the education, the support, the referral network, the resources that individuals as well as healthcare providers need.
How can a healthcare practitioner help to identify patients who should be screened for T1D?
So this is a really good question because we really do need everyone that's involved in the care of someone who is at risk for developing type 1 diabetes to be aware of what the current recommendations are and who should be screened. So when we're talking about any type of chronic disease, we know that family history is probably the lowest hanging fruit. And that is true also for type 1 diabetes. So having a first degree family member with type 1 diabetes increases the likelihood for that individual 15-fold that they would then develop it. So first degree relative is, of course, parents, siblings, and then children. So we have to think of the entire family in that individual that's identified. Unfortunately, those that actually present with new onset type 1 diabetes, only 10% of them will have this family history. So, you know, our lowest hanging fruit isn't giving us our greatest yield. So we actually need to start looking for different fruit from different trees. And so that is really where understanding the autoimmune nature of type 1 diabetes and the relationship of other autoimmune disorders will come in to help us to identify individuals at risk. So what I like to say, there's two things we know about autoimmunity. The first is that it's like a roach. And so what is the saying? When you see one roach, that there's typically...
there's more hiding.
Exactly.
I hate roaches.
Sorry, that's why you were like, ew. So right, there's more hiding. And that's what I like to use as an analogy for autoimmune disease in general, is that when we find one, we are screening for others because they seldom show up one and no other. There's usually more to follow. And the second thing we know about autoimmunity is that it clusters in families. So while you may not have a direct family member with type 1 diabetes, we know that there are other autoimmune disorders that share that HLA complex that type 1 diabetes lives. And those autoimmune diseases include autoimmune hypothyroid, autoimmune hyperthyroid, so Hashimoto's or Graves' disease, rheumatoid arthritis, pernicious anemia, or the inability to absorb vitamin B12 in the gut. There's so many others, and there's others that are not HLA linked. So we also have type A gastritis that is common in people with autoimmune disorders. So we really need to kind of expand. And so while the individual that may present with new onset type 1 does not have a family history for type 1 diabetes, upon investigation, we might find that they do have family members that have Hashimoto's, maybe Graves, maybe rheumatoid arthritis. They might not know what pernicious anemia is, but if I ask them if anyone in their family needed to actually receive injections for the treatment of B12, then they may say, oh yeah, I do have someone that had that. And that's your cue usually that it was pernicious anemia because they don't respond to oral. So knowing how to ask those questions is also important. And so as I said, autoimmunity begets autoimmunity, and we really need to be thinking about that constellation, the ones that are common in that HLA complex with type 1 diabetes, and ensure that we are getting the family history. And a lot of folks may not know their family history, so sometimes that's going to be homework for the patient that presents when I see them for the first time.
Any other challenges you've encountered in getting patients screened for T1D?
So personally, I have not had any challenges. In fact, the other healthcare providers in the endocrine practice that I am with have not had any issue with screening patients. Their openness to it, I think because they're in a specialty clinic, they're in an endocrinology clinic, so they're more open to what we might have to say. So we don't get as much of the pushback. And we're confident in what we're discussing with them. And so as a primary care provider, you may not feel as confident about what to discuss and what labs to draw. And, you know, and so that is a barrier for that clinician to discuss with the patient as well as to maybe identify patients. Some people will ask me about cost of screening. So please understand that when you're screening for type 1 diabetes, you're screening for autoantibodies. We are not doing genetic testing, genetic sequencing. We're not doing any of that stuff. And so the autoantibodies are rather straightforward. They're accessible through the commercial labs, and they're affordable. And I have not had yet a patient come back and say that they were charged X amount of dollars because their insurance would not cover the screening. And when I'm screening someone for type 1 diabetes, like I said, it's not just a one and done. I am repeating that test periodically because I either have identified at least one autoantibody and I'm looking for more, or I just, they have a high degree of suspicion because of their family history. So, and I, again, I've not had any issues. And something that will help with the clinicians to ensure that their labs will not be called into question is to make sure your documentation and the ICD-10 codes that you use support the why of what you are doing. So making sure if they have a family history for diabetes, that's a Z code. You can use that Z code, family history for type 1 diabetes. I don't know all these codes off the top of my head. That is where I use Google to Google ICD-10 codes. And then I just put in what I'm trying to find and can get them that way. But there's a lot of Z codes that you can use. Screening for diabetes, screening for a suspected endocrine disorder. So even if they already have a diagnosis of type 2, but you're not sure that that's what it is, you can put in some of these other screening codes. And so again, your documentation and your ICD-10 codes that you're going to link to those orders will make it easy. LabCorp and Quest are probably the most common of the commercial labs that we all use in this in the United States. And both of those now have a profile that groups all four of the autoantibodies that you need to order into one order set. It's the autoimmune profile for both Quest as well as LabCorp. And it will include the GAD65, the insulin autoantibody, or the IAA, the IA2, and the zinc transporter 8 antibody. So all four of those would be included. You do not need to be ordering C-peptides or anything like that when you're screening. This is to screen is really just getting those antibody tests done. And we screen, like I said, we screen regardless of age. If anyone has a first-degree relative with type 1 and or a personal or family history for another autoimmune disorder that's closely associated with type 1. We proactively screen all adults under the age of 40 who have an A1C of 5.7 to 6.4, especially if that's really all they have. You know, I've got patients that see me for obesity management, and they may not have any of the complications of obesity. Insulin resistance, they don't have hypertension, those kind of things. But they're seeing me for management of obesity. And if I see that they've had an A1C in the pre-diabetes range, at 5.7 to 6.4, they say, yeah, I was told I have pre-diabetes, and they put me on metformin. That's another person I'm definitely going to be screening with antibodies to make sure that, you know, they're not being misclassified as identified as pre-type 2 when they actually have pre-type 1. So, you know, and then keeping in line with that, anyone who doesn't have other signs or symptoms that would be consistent with insulin resistance. And I mentioned, you know, the value of the lipid panel. Do they have acanthosis nigricans? That's more of a insulin resistance. But the issue with that, too, is that we do see overlap. So you could have insulin resistance and also have type 1 diabetes. There's nothing that says you can't have, you know, both an autoimmune and a not autoimmune disorder living together. So again, I think it behooves us to just look at the patient more holistically. Anyone who's not responding to treatment the way they should, and I'm talking about, we've got GLP-GIP combinations, we've got the SGLT2 inhibitors, those drugs work. And if you have a patient where they're just not able to get an A1C of less than 7, and you have them not only on those drugs, but several others, we need to start looking a little bit more into what's going on with their beta cell and do they possibly have type 1 diabetes.
Can you describe some ways in which a diabetes care and education specialist can work collaboratively with other members of the patient's healthcare team from screening to potentially treating stage 2 T1D?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, working collaboratively and ensuring individuals are aware of their risk is a superpower of the certified diabetes care and education specialists. So, you know, again, they can recognize people are at risk, recommend that screening, educate, and it's not just the individuals and the families of that individual they see, but it's in the team within they're usually embedded, because most CDCESs are part of a care team. And so making sure that they're informing their colleagues about the benefits as well as the process of screening, engaging with the community. So many of them are involved outside of the workspace and do remarkable things. And they have that stage, that media presence even, to put that word out. And again, just to educate and to promote screening, understanding why we then monitor once we've identified somebody. We have the resources, they have at their fingertips, you know, a network of things that they can provide as far as where to send a patient, what website can they get information from, so on and so forth. They are an essential team member, and I think highly underutilized, truly. And I think the more that people are aware of the GEM, especially if you are working or you have these within your network, you really need to latch on to your diabetes care and education specialists.
What are some strategies you've been able to employ in getting a patient access to disease-modifying therapies like teplizumab as early as possible?
Well, you said it right there. As early as possible is the key. And right now, the only treatment we have available that can delay the progression of type 1 diabetes to the stage 3, where they actually require exogenous insulin, screening is going to be necessary, because teplizumab is currently only indicated for people who have stage 2 type 1 diabetes. So stage 1 is the presence of autoantibodies, but no sign of problems with glucose. Their A1Cs are not in the pre-BM range. Their, you know, glucoses are normal. So they would be asymptomatic, but they have autoantibodies, but they're not qualified yet for receiving teplizumab. Stage 2 type 1 diabetes is they have, again, the presence of at least 2 positive autoantibodies. And now we're starting to see the A1C going into that range of 5.7 to 6.4. Their fasting glucose is 100 to 125. So we're starting to see the glucoses are creeping. This isn't where we would typically diagnose someone as having overt diabetes. We might say they have prediabetes. But once someone has positive autoantibodies, even when their glucoses are normal, they have now type 1 diabetes. It's just, what stage are they in? So stage 1 is nothing as far as glucose issues. Stage 2 is some changes. They're elevated, not to the point where we would normally consider starting insulin. Stage 3 is when the glucoses have exceeded that threshold. They are in that, you know, classic diagnostic of an A1C of 6.5 or higher, or, you know, fasting glucose 126 or higher, and you know what those parameters are. But that's typically where we would need to implement insulin in stage 3. And so the point of screening is to identify those folks, because when you're in stage 2, you are asymptomatic. Nobody knows that you have anything going on with diabetes if you have never been looked at for autoantibodies or anything like that. And those are the ones that we're missing. And if we don't catch them then and they develop stage 3, teplizumab is, again, it's not indicated for the use in stage 3, at least not at this point. And so we don't really have anything available at this time, FDA approved, for those that have stage 3, other than, of course, insulin. And we have some, you know, islet cell transplantation that we can use, but that's late stage as well. The earlier we can identify, the earlier we can provide options such as treatment. If they're not interested in treatment, and some patients won't be, the other benefit is, again, to give them that soft landing to ensure they don't end up in diabetic ketoacidosis, educate them on the signs and symptoms of extremely elevated blood sugars, and maybe teaching them about insulin so that they have maybe a supply of a basal insulin at home, because it always happens on the Friday night of a long holiday weekend that they're going to run into trouble. And that's when they usually can't get in touch with anybody. So again, trying to minimize the aggressiveness of when the disease actually presents itself.
So time is of the essence, literally, for these patients with stage 2 T1D. Time may actually give them more time down the road. Any final tips or strategies our audience can consider when managing a patient with early stage T1D?
I think as a final, again, prescribing the gift of time. Like you said, if we give them time now, they may have more time later. And so that's what screening actually does. It gives them some time to acclimate, to ask questions, to get used to what's going on. When you are identifying individuals who have either stage 1 or stage 2, you have already accomplished some very important objectives. You've identified them. You're preventing, hopefully, DKA. You're giving them that education, refer them to those diabetes care and education specialists, opening them up to resources. Once they have 2 positive autoantibodies, they actually have type 1 diabetes. And so that is a diagnostic code. We have a diagnostic code that says type 1 diabetes, not yet using insulin, if you want to go that detailed. But having type 1 diabetes opens up the door to CGM and other types of monitoring that they may not have coverage for otherwise, depending on their insurance. So I guess the other piece is keeping the roach thing in mind, the autoimmune connection. And that proper diet and exercise, this is another piece, will not alter the course of autoimmunity. We do see that proper diet, exercise, losing weight can alter the course for type 2 diabetes because it's a disease of insulin resistance. But autoimmunity is a different breed altogether. And so while those things are extremely important for overall health and wellness, it won't change or alter the course of whether or not someone's going to develop type 1 diabetes. It can, if those things are not in place, can increase insulin resistance and, of course, impact the progression to stage 3 and make the management of their type 1 more difficult. So those things are important, but they're not going to alter the natural history. And again, I can't say it enough, early referral to your certified diabetes care and education specialist and sending them to the diabetes self-management education and support classes is so, so important.
Lucia, thank you for your time and your insights and your expertise. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun. I hope everyone out there is getting the message. Screen and prescribe time.
This concludes the latest edition of our Detect T1D podcast series. I would like to once again thank Ms. Lucia Novak for joining and for sharing her expertise on T1D, and to thank you for taking the time to listen. This podcast was supported by an educational grant from Sanofi US and was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please join us for another episode of this podcast series on T1D. For more podcasts and other accredited activities, please visit us online at www.medlearninggroup.com. Thank you.